Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. In honor of the first year anniversary of the McGuinty Government Study on Poverty from April 2008, we have two of the presenters from the April 14th Anti-Poverty Symposium, both members of the STOP Speakers Bureau in Toronto, tell us about their own personal experiences and their viewpoints on what's needed to turn around poverty. First, our guest Nadia, and then our guest Angèle on disrespect.
Disrespect introduces Nadia, a guest from the STOP Speakers Bureau in Toronto, who helped put on a workshop at the symposium on Monday, April the 14th, and the subject of the workshop, I believe, was agency discrimination. Nadia, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
All right. Have I got that right? You put on a workshop about agency discrimination?
Well, the workshop was actually put on by Pat Capone.
Oh, good. Okay.
And we were guest speakers at the workshop, so we kind of facilitated the workshop a bit.
Okay.
It was really interesting
All right. To
hear what people had to say.
All right. What did they have to say?
Well, one of my biggest thing I found yesterday at this workshop were people were saying that agencies do not respect them as human beings.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And
I'm laughing because, I mean, I could have said the same thing, but nobody believes it, yeah.
I don't think nobody listens to anybody.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping out of this that people will actually start to understand the problems that agencies cause in other people's lives.
Yeah.
And I had a big issue about people with disabilities. Why are they given problems when they go to agencies or even from their workers, which was one of the other things we heard a lot of yesterday.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I was shocked because I thought that workers were trained
right
to take care of those people properly to
yeah
ensure that they need some meds, but
yeah, yeah.
I found out yesterday that's not the case.
No, no. I don't know if there is such a form of training. I suspect there is for specific disabilities.
Okay.
Well, I know George Brown offers a course for deaf and blind interveners, for
yes
instance. But I don't know that there is a course that deals with how to inquire and how to define and how to assist someone who has a disability.
Well, wouldn't that be in our human nature itself to take care of people who are less vulnerable than ourselves? Like,
you would hope so. I mean, in my opinion, it seems more to be human nature if you have power to use it to make life simpler for yourself rather than the people you have power over.
For sure.
Yeah. So,
for sure.
So how was agency defined for this workshop? How did they, where'd they draw the line? What's an agency and what's not? Is ODSP an agency?
Well, that's a good question. That's a really good question. We spoke about drop-in centers.
Oh, okay.
We spoke about a couple drop-in centers, and
yeah
then we talked a lot about workers, for sure.
Okay.
That was like, it just, you know, you have a workshop, and then you have to do what, answer the questions that the people want. And a lot of the issues were around workers with people on Ontario disabilities.
Oh, okay.
So this is a real issue. And I'm hoping that our next step will be something around that, how workers treat clients with disabilities or something along that line.
Okay. What was discussed at the presentation that you had?
Well, we basically we gave our stories, and then There was a question period.
Yeah.
There was a question and answer where people ask questions and try to work on things, issues they have.
Yeah.
And we had one lady who talked about her experience with drop-in centers.
Tell someone who's listening on the radio, what is a drop-in center if they've never been to one?
Okay, basically a drop-in center is a place where you could go have a meal. Some facilities offer laundry.
Yeah.
They offer a place for you to meet with other people.
Okay.
Job search.
Okay.
They're supposed to provide resources for clients and a whole range of like basic wellness services, I guess.
So it could be different for every drop-in center, but there's a core of sort of wellness-oriented services that it's common to most of them, eh?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, for example, the stop, we have a variety of, we have healthy beginnings.
People probably won't even understand what it was you said, but you mean the Stop Community Food Center, right, in Toronto?
Yes, I do. Yep. Yes, on Davenport and Simonton.
Okay. And at the stop?
At the stop, we have a drop-in where people could come in and have a meal.
Right.
They serve breakfast and lunch.
Yeah.
And they have, you could watch a movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's a Healthy Beginnings program.
There's a what program?
Healthy Beginnings.
Okay.
For people who are pregnant.
Okay.
They get to see a dietitian, a counselor.
Oh, yeah.
And a whole range, you get a food token,
yep,
and a whole range of other things.
Okay.
Then they don't provide laundry facilities, but they have a food bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I'm not forgetting anything. There's a community kitchen.
Well, you give me a good idea of what kind of a place the stop is. I mean, from the point of view of someone who's dropping in. And the stop is a more than usually comprehensive drop-in center, isn't it? I mean, it offers more than a lot of them.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Definitely provides a lot more services than any other drop-in center.
Well, what are the other drop-in centers' shortcomings?
Well, yesterday we heard that they don't treat people with dignity.
Yes.
A lot.
Yeah. What does that mean? And when you go to a drop-in center, or someone you know goes to a drop-in center, and what is that like?
Yes, he said that.
Who said?
The other lady, I can't remember her name.
No, that's okay. But there was another presenter?
Yes.
Okay.
And she was saying that even if to use the laundry or to use the phone or something simple as to send a fax,
yeah,
the workers would have that thing like they have all the power.
Yeah.
And you below them. And it was just, they just treat people badly. I have never really used a drop-in center.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Other than the stop for Healthy Beginnings.
Well, what was the story? Did you tell a story about discrimination at an agency?
My story was more about discrimination with Ontario Works.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us a little about that.
Well, it was more towards the fact that on Ontario Works, you have to struggle so much, and if you do try to make a future for yourself,
yeah,
there's basically no help available for you.
Okay. I'm sorry. That's a shame for an agency that's supposed to help people get off dependence on fixed incomes, yeah.
Exactly. And I was basically talking about I had a son who got accepted at St. Michael's Boys Choir.
Oh, wow.
And basically, I couldn't send him because I was an assistant. And I felt that my son, because you have to pay, even though you got a scholarship, I had to pay the first year. And
I don't understand. Who got the scholarship? Your son?
He did, but you have to commit to 1 year.
And the scholarship doesn't apply to the first year?
No, because the parent has to commit to the first year.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it's understandable. It's a really good school.
Yeah.
And basically, I was told if I send him there, I'll be cut off.
Oh. Why would you be cut off?
Because they're saying if I could afford the first year tuition, I could afford to take care of myself.
Oh, okay. So they weren't thinking of your son. They were thinking of their rules.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And I found out that there's a lot of people out there like me. So I decided to, okay, let me get off assistance and go back to college and make a future for myself and my kids.
Yeah.
and the same thing, you cut off assistance, no help, you have to take a loan. Then you have to pay back that loan.
Yeah, and the loan really isn't meant to live on. It's meant to assist you with college fees, but if they cut you off, you have to live on it too, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had to, basically I'm leaving on OSAP.
I'm sorry, you were living on
On OSAP, that loan.
You did this?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I did this.
Yeah.
I'm not an assistant anymore, and I went back to college, and I'm surviving on...
Oh, so you're in college now?
Yes, I went to George Brown.
Okay, good. And how do you mind my asking how much you're living on? Is it less than your assistants?
Well, she claims more than my assistants for the year, because they look at it on a one-year basis, which doesn't make any sense to me.
Is it more than your assistants, or is it not? And if it's not, do you know what they're looking at that's wrong?
Well, they're calculating it over a one-year period, and I think last year it was 1,100,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And then OSAP for the year, I think, is 1,600 or 15-something.
But they don't count your tuition or anything, do they?
No, they don't. They don't minus the tuition. And the 1,600 includes tuition.
Oh, that's stupid.
It is stupid.
Yeah.
But what can I say?
Yeah. So you did it anyway.
I did it anyway. Because if I don't, my kids are going to... And like in that yesterday, it was a lot about child poverty. And it was everything. And there was three different women from three different places. There was Jane Cornwell had a video. And it was talking about child poverty.
Yeah.
And another lady from Northern Bay even spoke about child poverty. And my speech was exactly the same thing. And I don't know any of those women. And it was like, if it's so much of an issue, if three different women from three different walks of life are talking about child poverty, and my stand on it is, if the children are tomorrow's future, what kind of future do we have?
Yeah.
They're going to be the ones who has to run society, and we're going to be old, and they have to take care of us. How are they going to do that if they can't function, if they have to live in poverty, if... One out of four children is starving.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds as if the way the system's set up, there's no credit for trying to get ahead.
There isn't.
Do you think it goes further than that? Do you think there's an envy of people who try to get ahead? Let's face it, they're not social workers anymore. They're clerks, okay? So they're clerks. They're making $29,000, $30,000 a year, which sounds like a lot when you're on welfare. But believe me, by the time they take income tax off and the daily expenses of living, it's not. Do you think they're jealous of you trying to get ahead? Or are they just working with rules that don't encourage your getting ahead? Is it personal or is it business, or is it both?
I would hope it's not personal.
That's nicely put.
I hope it's not personal.
Very nicely put. Okay, all right. Was there anything you wanted to sum up about what you explored in the workshop yesterday? I mean, some overall point of view.
Well, overall, I think it was a really good workshop. We had a little over 500 people.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Huge. It was big. And I was happy to see so many people and hoping that they were all in the room for the same reason.
That they were what in the room?
I was hoping that they all in this room to help end poverty.
Okay.
Because it was a poverty reduction strategy.
And yep.
I'm hoping that after this, people don't just walk out there and like, okay, whatever. And, yeah.
Okay, good.
To make some change.
Yeah. Well, you've taken...
Because we need the change. We need it. I heard from so many people yesterday, and I'm hoping and praying that something will be done soon, or else we're going to lose the country.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, you've heard the phrase, be the change you want in the world, and you've done that. And I hope these other people take that up, too.
I know. And I hope people out there listening, like, just don't, like, sit there and okay, I can't change it. Because it takes one person to make a change.
Yeah, that's true.
So if everybody bands, there was the saying yesterday that fishes swim in groups because they're stronger in a group and we're weak as individuals. But if we come together as a group, we could make so much noise. Like, there's so many people on disability. If everybody bands together, join with the agencies, join with the community leaders, like, and they work hard on this and beat it to death. Like everybody just make noise about it.
Okay.
Somebody's going to listen, hopefully.
Oh, beat it to death, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. I did an interview recently where I was told that it's past time asking other people to come up with the solutions, that, like your observation that assistance to someone who is going to school should take into account that they have to bear the cost of going to school. That kind of proposal, practical proposal, is what's needed now.
Yes.
Not that someone should be in the government should be told, well, we have a problem over going to school, but that someone in the government should be told, when we go to school, we don't want people to think we're living high on the money that we pay to the school, because we don't have that money anymore. We gave it to the school. So why can't we get it from our benefits to get off the benefits?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you have your kids to take care of, because I have three kids. I'm a single mother of three kids.
Yeah.
I have my kids to take care of, rent to pay, everything else to pay. And then they're saying to me that, well, you're going to be cut off because the money is more. That doesn't make sense to me. Like, it's all about... why not help the people who want... they want to make decisions for it. And another thing that came up yesterday was they send them to those workshops that doesn't make any sense and they don't want to do it. Why spend money and send people to the same workshop over and over again, the same training over and over again?
You mean the beneficiaries, the recipients of the benefits?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, sure.
That came up yesterday. This lady was saying she was 50-something and they sent her to a computer training program. Like,
yeah.
50-something.
Yeah.
Why not send her to something she's interested in and something she's going to want to do?
Like, yeah.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Okay. So one size fits all when, in fact, everybody's a little different and everybody has their own wish to get off the benefits,
yes.
Not accommodated.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
So these people should all, each individually, after this workshop, they should all speak up, tell somebody who has power over them what they really want and what can really be done.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'm hoping that's what's going to happen.
That would be a nice outcome for the workshop. Well, Nadia, I really appreciate your spending time with us out of what must be a very busy schedule if you're raising three kids and going to school. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm running around doing speaker bureau. That's okay, but yeah. I'm happy.
Okay.
I really love doing this, and I'm hoping that with me doing this will make a change for myself, my children, and other people out there like me.
I hope that's, so, too.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
No problem. Anytime.
All right.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the first of two presenters from the Stop Community Food Center's Speakers Bureau and their recount of their presentations at the April 14th Anti-Poverty Symposium in Toronto and their proposals for solutions to the problems that they've encountered. This was Nadia. Coming up, Angèle.
Disrespect welcomes to the show Angèle, a member of the Stop Speakers Bureau, who was at the Symposium on Poverty on April the 14th and facilitated the presentation. Angèle, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff.
What was your part in the presentation? I gather you spoke of personal experiences, did you?
Yes, I did. Yes.
And they were around discrimination by agencies?
It was around discrimination by society.
Okay.
It was about discrimination... by society, by how we get the type of eyewear that we wear, whether we have been able to afford root canals or whether we are judged by the fact that we have teeth missing. That was what I spoke about.
Okay. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that presentation and how it was received?
I think the whole symposium was well received.
Oh, good. I understand there were 500 people there.
I think it was 600.
Wow.
Like six. That's my understanding. I may be wrong.
Okay.
And I believe it was very well received, except that I was a little disappointed with the minister.
Deb Matthews?
Okay. Yes. She stated, but we have to be realistic.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what does realistic mean?
Yeah.
You know, who decides what realism is?
Yeah.
With the past government.
Yeah.
It was realistic not to send people into Afghanistan.
Right.
But now, without asking the Canadians, that they go ahead and they can't fix the social ills in our own country.
Yeah.
they use evasion through semantics, saying that they have to measure poverty.
Yes.
But it's probably the most easily measured of all social ills.
Right.
Whereas they go and interfere in another country, and really because there's a pipeline, oil pipeline running through it.
Right.
So let's take care of our own first.
Yeah.
And it's very, very frustrating.
Yes, so what did you tell people about? You had experiences with dental work. You had experiences with eyewear.
Yes, I did.
Yeah? And what were those experiences?
Well, when I was in my 20s, I drove cab. And So I was definitely one of the working poor.
Yeah.
And I thought I just needed, you know, drilling and filling for my teeth.
Yeah.
When the dentist said I needed a root canal, and that was a front tooth, and I had all my front teeth when I went into that office.
Yeah.
And I hadn't been to the dentist for a while.
Yeah.
And it was a new dentist. I offered, you know, a gold chain and pendant as collateral or my license. He didn't know me, so, you know, like that day I ended up walking out of there without a front tooth. And, you know, I'm thinking, the way that society is, I may have progressed from being a cab driver if my self-esteem and self-worth would not have gone down because of the brutality of pulling something that people judge you so well by. So,
disfiguring you.
Yeah, disfiguring, exactly. And I never thought of driving a cab as being a career. It was just something I was doing. I started in the summer as a part-time sort of thing.
Yeah.
Then it became a rut for a while, and I think it's taken so long for them to even recognize how brutal it is to pull people's teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you had experiences with the eyewear program as well?
Well, basically what I spoke about was how people judge you so quickly according to, you know, whether you can afford the high fashion glasses.
Oh, okay.
Whether or not, you know, you have your own front teeth. And, you know, it's like in Ontario, there are the privileged and the poor. It's two classes of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, just upon glancing at somebody, if they can afford a proper haircut, it's so easily that you can be left out of situations or because of the way you look. And
it's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. And this last winter, I've been wearing for the second year a down jacket that I picked up in Winners for about $35. Now it doesn't have a snazzy logo on the front or a brand name. And most places I go, I've been treated as if I've come to steal something, which really surprised me. I've never been treated like that before. But I have to say, two winters ago, I was wearing a jacket. It was 4 years old. I had to keep getting it mended because it was worn so thin. It said Ralph Lauren had a little polo horse on the front. And that jacket cost me, even at Winners, it cost me $200. But the difference in the treatment I got was night and day. And I've never been treated like a thief before, on first glance. And I didn't like it. I thought, as you thought, that this has gone too far, that the cutting down of incomes and the compartmentalizing of people on fixed incomes has become a straitjacket for everybody.
Exactly.
I did shows a month ago, three shows, on the effect of low fixed rates of reimbursement on the professionals and indirectly on the people who use those services. Dentists, optometrists, and opticians, none of their rates have gone up for 15 years. It's the same as people on fixed incomes. They're stuck, but they work for a living, and they all have the right to turn people on fixed incomes away. Is it any surprise that they've started, not the dentists apparently, but opticians and optometrists have started questioning people on fixed incomes, whether they want to work for them? And the optometrists themselves have jacked up their rates for people who can afford to pay to cover the rates for people who can't afford to pay. So that if you can't afford to pay, they get maybe a little over $40 from the government. And if you want coatings, you have to ask the optometrist for a letter, which he's not paid for. which says it's included in that $40, which says that coatings are medically necessary. Now, if you break those glasses,
those coatings are not covered anymore.
No,
I had to.
You can get them if you can get your optometrist to say that they're medically necessary.
Well, I needed. Oh, I got medically necessary. Yeah. Okay, but
yeah,
a lot of things are not covered anymore that were, and instead of going forwards, we go one step forwards, five steps back.
Well, you asked the optometrist to write such a letter, and how does the optometrist feel? Already he's getting paid half his rate for paying customers, which is about $80 now. He's getting paid $40 by you, and you need a letter, which, as far as I know, he's not getting paid extra for. Now, the cute part comes if you break those glasses or you damage those glasses and you go back and you said, I'm sorry, I was knocked down by a bicycle or I slipped on some ice and my glasses are chipped, cracked, broken, whatever, I need to replace them. They give you a note that says replace the glasses. It doesn't include replacing the coatings. You have to go back to that same optometrist, who's still not paid, and ask him for a second letter. You know, the crackdown, it's like you don't deserve these things. Even if they're medically necessary, you have to go back and beg for a second letter.
Exactly.
You know, and this begging seems to have gone a little far,
we
too.
We don't deserve very much, the poor. And
no.
They're responsible for all the ills of society.
Did you present that point of view at the symposium?
I attempted to.
Yeah? What is your point of view on responsibility for the ills of society and how we're presented?
I believe that with this government, we are blamed
for
the ills of mainstream society, yes. And
yeah.
We are excluded.
I
believe we are excluded from mainstream society just by the way we are being treated.
Yeah. And where does the blame come in? Basically, like being excluded from a party? You're not good enough looking, or you don't belong,
You're not deserving. And it's a lot of, if you are poor automatically, a lot of tags are attached to you, such as you must be lazy or...
Right.
It's like a prejudice that is not recognized for being a prejudice that is okay.
Yeah. Do you think we're still dealing with this point of view that the Harris government put forward?
Well, Jeff, you know what is funny? Last September the 29th, I went to my cousin's wedding.
Yeah.
And I'm excluded from my relatives, except that the cousin happened to invite me because I happened to have been at my father's funeral earlier in the year.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that the professional photographers would eventually put it on the internet, so I purchased a digital camera, and I didn't have any pictures of myself taken.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I just took pictures of everybody else, and...
You were the one who put up the website?
No. There was a professional photographer at my cousin's wedding.
Right.
And I assumed I would be in some of the pictures.
Oh, okay.
And I, you know, I hadn't gone to a fancy wedding for a very long time because I am poor. So what happened was that my one cousin from Boston, he was talking about how he makes donations to the church in Boston. And then there was something he said that I found really strange. And he asked me what I do, and I said, well, I'm an activist. And then I got a little bit into it. And he said, well, poor people, they are unambitious, lazy, and evil. And I said,
evil.
And like I was like, wait a minute. You know, don't you do your charity work for the Roman Catholic Church?
Yeah.
And he said evil, and you know, I was just kind of stunned, and I thought it went really well, but then at the end of the wedding, we were given these cards from the photographer saying that the photos would be on a website. I didn't know that was how it was done. When I went to that website, when the photos were on there, there wasn't one photo of me, and there were at least 500 photos. And that hurts. So what you were saying about that
how's this related to the guy who thought you're evil?
He was my cousin. He's a cousin. How is it related? It's related that I was not good enough to be on those photos because they chose who to put on there.
Yeah, yeah.
And because I guess I am poor and evil. I mean, they are very close-knit. What I'm trying to say, Jeff, is that...
Oh, so there probably were pictures of you, but they chose not to put them up.
Yes, I was at the table, the cousin's table. There were two tables. There were two cousin's tables. I was at one of the cousin's tables. So definitely, that was in the front. Definitely, it was a huge, huge wedding. Definitely, there were photos taken, yet the ones with me in them, I was they were not there.
Yeah.
And so I have absolutely no pictures of myself having attended that event. That's how, and that hurts. That's how society still is.
Yeah.
And that really, really hurt. And that was just September the 29th, so.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, like, we think that we are so far ahead in society, but we're still in the Middle Ages when it comes to humanity, and you know, like, people assume they know what's in your heart just by how much money you have in your wallet.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, I appreciate your expressing that point of view. It's not often expressed so clearly, and the hurt of it's not expressed so clearly. I'm not approving of it. I'm not advocating it. Mm-hmm. But I'm a little surprised that when you open your door every morning and there's somebody sleeping in their own urine on your doorstep, that you don't think it's going to affect you.
Very good point, Jeff.
I think there's a general feeling that people with disabilities are from another race, that they're genetically different and they were born inferior, and they're still inferior and maybe lazy and dishonest too. But the truth is, you take a healthy person and you disrespect them and you tell them that there's nothing that they can do. And if they do take it inside, the stress is going to disable them alone. The stress is a terrible burden to bear. And then the costs for all of society go up.
Exactly.
So either way, the costs go up. You live in a society with bigger prisons, more police, less respect for your privacy, and more violence in the streets, and you live in a society of more disability, more ill health, higher health costs, more people living on the streets, and higher taxes. And I think the links are beginning to be built, and I think your symposium was one of them, but I think the links are beginning to be built between the homeless people, the mentally ill people, and the people who have not gotten there yet, but who are suffering the same indignities. I think that's what the symposium was about, with building these links.
I couldn't have said it better. Very, very, very well said, Jeff.
Yeah, well, I couldn't have said it without your comments to sort of bring it home.
Thank you. Thank you for speaking with me, and I'm honored to be on your show, Jeff.
All right, thanks, Angelle.
Okay, so thanks, and have a good week, Jeff.
All right.
You've just heard Angelle, a presenter from the Speakers Bureau of the Stop Community Food Center, discuss her contribution to the Anti-Poverty Symposium on April 14th in Toronto and her thoughts on solutions for poverty for Ontario. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. Remember, these are not the full stories we read, but excerpts from the stories, whose titles and authors that we quote. At the end of the second half, we're going to give you the times and locations for the Out of the Cold Pot Meal program. And if you don't already have them, get those pens and pencils now so you can write them down when we announce at the end of the show. Sit back and enjoy the review of the news. First, an announcement. This Friday, 11:30 in the morning, a group from Toronto and Hamilton are gathering to discuss the first anniversary of Dalton McGuinty's promise to study poverty and what to do about it with the campaign that's been a year running called Do the Math. It promises to be interesting. A lot of activists there. Drop down to the Welcome Inn if you're free. Friday morning, 11:30, 40 Wood Street on James, just south of Burlington. Do the Math. Our first story. This by Denise Davey, the Hamilton Spectator, Wednesday, November 25th. 1 in 4 Hamilton children living in poverty. Joan Nelson remembers the boy who sat waiting with his mother at the Welcome Inn food bank. It was a warm day last summer, and the mother had an old stroller to cart the food home. The boy was around 7 and had a broken arm. He seemed distant, removed. There was just something about him, said Nelson, acting director at Welcome Inn Community Center. The experience seemed different for him than it was for his mother. In Hamilton, 1 in 4 children under 15 are living in poverty. Every month, some 9,000 children access food banks, an increase of 33% from last year. Agencies say Hamilton families have been hard hit by the recession. Nelson estimates they've had a 60% increase in the number of families using their food bank in the last 2 years. Most are either families on welfare or the working poor. Some are working 3 or 4 jobs to get by, she said. Denise Arkell, director of Neighbor to Neighbor Food Bank, said the recession has made it more difficult, as have higher grocery prices. Carrie Astley's volunteer coordinator at Welcome Inn said they're seeing more children because of the increase in families working for minimum wage or part-time. Others have exhausted their employment benefits. Standing in line at a food bank is not the best place for a child. It's not where they want to be, Astley said. In the Globe, Andre Picard, second opinion. Money, the most powerful drug. Life expectancy in Canada rivals that of almost any country in the world. A girl born today can expect to live on average to 82 and a boy to a more modest 76.9, according to StatsCan. But life expectancy is a crude measure, tells a superficial story, so there have been many attempts to drill down into the data. There are, for example, wide regional variations. Those who are healthiest and live longest are on the Pacific coast, and the numbers get gradually worse as you move across the nation to the Atlantic region. Then, when you look to the north, the numbers take a precipitous drop. In the territories, life expectancy is similar to that in low- and middle-income countries. Just as there are regional variations, there are differences across the lifespan. Those who die early tend to skew data on average life expectancy. Statistics Canada decided to calculate disability-free life expectancy. DFLE is a way of looking beyond mortality to the preceding morbidity. DFLE is estimated at 68.6 years in Canada, compared to a life expectancy of 78.3. That means most people can expect to live almost a decade with a significant physical or mental disability before they die. It's well established there are many contributors to poor health. In addition to genetics, which play a relatively small role, socioeconomic status, and to a lesser extent, lifestyle choices have a tremendous impact. Those socioeconomic determinants include education, housing, physical environment, and, above all, income. Put bluntly, poverty makes people unhealthy and poverty kills. While this may seem self-evident, a group of researchers at StatsCan has managed to calculate the impact of poverty, or as they say, income disparities, on life expectancy. The findings, published in the Journal Health Reports, are eye-opening. Only 51.2% of Canadian men in the lowest income group, the bottom 10%, can expect to live to age 75. By comparison, 74.6% of high-income earners, the top 10%, can expect to see 75. That's a startling 23.4-point difference, not good odds. For women, the comparative figures are 69.4% of poor women living to 75, compared with 84.4% of wealthy women, a smaller but still significant 15-point gap. Put another way, at age 25, a poor man can expect to live an additional 48.6 years. A wealthy man can expect 56 years, a 7.4-year gap. A poor 25-year-old woman can be expected to live 56.5 more years, compared with 61 years for a wealthy woman of the same age. That gap is 4.5 years. Statistics Canada applies the HALE measure, health-adjusted life expectancy, an attempt to measure not only quantity but quality of life. And it found that those gaps between poor and rich were even more considerable. Being wealthy translated into 11.4 more years of healthy living for men and 9.7 for women. When they crunched the numbers further, the statistics found that even if you compare the health-adjusted life expectancy of the highest income earners with those of the average person, the difference was still 5.9 years for men and 4.2 years for women. To put those numbers in context, consider that cancer, the number one killer in Canada, reduces health-adjusted life expectancy by 2.8 years for men and 2.5 years for women. The bottom line, people's income, or the lack of it, has about twice the impact on their health as cancer does. That is a humbling bit of data. The group Campaign 2000 has released its 2009 report card on child and family poverty in Canada. It showed that 637,000 children are still living in low-income families 2 decades after federal politicians vowed to eradicate child poverty. One can only despair that in a country with one of the highest life expectancies in the world, these children are being deprived of almost a decade of life from the get-go, and we seem largely indifferent. This from the Globe and Mail, Saturday, November 28th, by Kirk Macon, Justice Reporter. One faction of the Supreme Court of Canada scolded another Friday, saying it let a legal technicality get in the way of justice for a group of Quebec Walmart workers who lost their jobs after organizing the union. A 6-3 majority concluded that the workers had chosen the wrong labor law provision to anchor allegations of union busting against the giant retailer in their challenge of its right to close the store in Jonquière, Quebec, where they had worked after they formed a union. However, a judge who has forged a reputation as pro-labor, Madam Justice Rosalie Abella, accused the majority of allowing an overly technical interpretation of the law to thwart scrutiny of Walmart's behavior. On behalf of Mr. Justice Louis LaBelle and Mr. Justice Thomas Cromwell, she called the majority decision a marked and arbitrary departure from the philosophical underpinnings, objectives, and general scope of the Labor Code. Labor leaders agreed with the minority yesterday, saying the decision had let Walmart off the hook. Said Wayne Hanley, National President of United Food and Commercial Workers of Canada, the workers at the Jonquière store know in their hearts why Walmart shut their store, he said. So do most Canadians. So does Walmart. Steve Barrett, a veteran Toronto labor lawyer, called the ruling a short-term, narrow, technical victory for Walmart and a disappointing result for the Quebec workers. The union just proceeded under the wrong provision of the code. Mr. Barrett viewed it as a very technical interpretation by the majority that was out of step not only with the law in the rest of the country, but with the language and purpose of Quebec's labor code. The company opened its Jonquière store in 2001. The workers formed a union but could not reach a collective agreement with the company. On February 9, 2005, the Minister of Labour referred the matter to arbitration and notified the parties of the referral. That same day, Walmart informed employees of its decision to close. One Walmart outlet in Quebec has won a collective agreement since the Jonquière case, and several others have been granted union certification. And on the same story, from an article in the National Post by Janice Tibbetts and Nicholas Van Preet in Ottawa and Toronto, court upholds Walmart closure. I don't think there's a doubt that Walmart won this case, and I think overall on certain issues the employer community did pretty good, said George Avram, a Baker & McKenzie lawyer who represented the Alliance of Manufacturers and Exporters Canada as an intervener in the case. That said, this case doesn't give a carte blanche to employers across the country to shut down their operations regardless of the reasons. If there's a case, they would award damages to employees, said Dominic Monet, leader of the Labor Employment and Human Rights Practice at law firm Fasken Martineau in Montreal. This is not a substantive victory for employers in any way whatsoever. The judges have certainly shown them the right exit to take on the highway next time. And from CBS News on the Internet, Social Security freeze, time to scrimp. This is about U.S. Social Security. In Canada, we're facing also a large level of debt and the need to claw back programs or raise taxes. But in the States, this is the form it's taken. With no annual raise due to negative inflation, seniors on fixed income take thrift to heart. If her check were bigger, 76-year-old Agnes Conti might be able to spring for a better cut of meat for her pot roast. She could afford to send her 9 grandchildren more than $20 for their birthdays and Christmas. She'd be able to buy some nice new clothes like she sees on QVC, not what she settles for at Walmart. If only. The government has said the Social Security checks Conti and tens of millions of other seniors rely on as their primary source of income will not increase next year as consumer prices have fallen overall. And while the retired hospital clerk will get by, she'll be watching her spending even closer, knowing she can't expect the annual raise she's been accustomed to. We were good citizens all our lives. We went to work. We lived by the book. We weren't on welfare. We didn't ask the city for anything, Conti said, while taking a break from crafts at a senior center here. And what do we get? at the Southwest Focal Point Senior Center in this Fort Lauderdale suburb of Pembroke Pines, seniors lamented the cost of living freeze and praised a White House plan for $250 checks to soften the blow. But they took all of the news in stride, saying they've had a lifetime experience living on a fixed income and would manage with the money they currently receive. Frank Ferreira sits in the center's lobby near a decorative fireplace in an autumn centerpiece. The 90-year-old retired truck driver loves to sing, even practicing on a karaoke machine at home, and loves to dance even more. He gets about $890 a month from Social Security, most of which he hands over to his daughter to help pay his share of the bills. The money isn't the biggest issue, Ferreira said. It's the message the government is sending. And if you're a parent on a fixed income, this may interest you. Disability Savings Plan, a godsend for parents, long overdue, by Gary Marr in the Financial Post. Former National Hockey League player Jim Kite knows a little something about living with a disability. He was the first deaf NHL hockey player. This week he confessed much of his wealth has been directed to one of his own children born with a disability, autism. Mr. Kyle agreed to appear on a conference call sponsored by Bank of Montreal to promote the bank's registered disability savings plan. BMO was the first bank to introduce RDSPs in December 2008 and is now first to offer the program to investment advisors through BMO Guardian Funds. The deadline to take advantage of the government grants and bonds available for RDSPs in 2009 is December 31st. When this tool of the RDSP came along, it was something that was long overdue, Mr. Kite said. We've been looking and trying to plan for the future. As a parent, when you have young children, you're always worried about the future and what will happen if you're not here. You buy life insurance and so forth. When the children get older, you want them to be contributing members of society. With my son, I hope he can do that, but I don't know. Under the Registered Disability Savings Plan, low-income earners receive a government bond just by registering, provided the recipient of the RDSP is eligible for the disability tax credit. When household net income is less than $21,816, the recipient receives a bond of $1,000. The grants require a contribution and are also income tested. When annual household income is less than $77,664, the recipient of the grant receives $3 for every dollar contributed on the first $500. So for a contribution of $500, the recipient would get a grant of $1,500. On the next $1,000, it's $2 for every $1 contributed. Linda Knight, co-president of BMO Investments, said, "We think it's an amazing program," adding that opening up an advisor channel for customers should add to the number of disabled registering. This will increase the access to RDSPs. This will give people greater access to opening up and talking about RDSPs. Globe and Mail, Saturday, November 28th. Kirk Macon, Justice Reporter. Facing wider legal aid boycott, ministry agrees to negotiate fee structures. Criminal lawyers in Ontario stopped short of expanding their legal aid boycott to include sexual assault cases yesterday after the Ministry of the Attorney General agreed to sit down and negotiate fee structures. However, Criminal Lawyers Association President Frank Addario told the CLA convention that the boycott will be expanded swiftly if a 60-day truce with the ministry turns out to be an empty effort to quell the legal aid revolt. This is the opportunity we've been asking for, to sit down and explain to them why the amount of money put there is inadequate to fix the program, Mr. Addario said. This set of discussions is not going to go on endlessly. It will not take very long to figure out whether the other side wants to fix the problem. Mr. Addario received a lengthy standing ovation for leading the legal aid fight. For the last 20 years, criminal lawyers have been masking a problem that was not of our own making, he told a convention of criminal lawyers. A string of experts told the government to fix the problem. It didn't listen. Mr. Addario said that the boycott marks the first time that criminal lawyers have taken action against the steady erosion of legal aid without losing their resolve and adopting a supine position as soon as the province counterattacked. Legal aid is not a charity, and the people who provide it are not volunteers, he said. From the Globe and Mail in brief, RCMP to probe 2003 taser death. Victoria, the RCMP Public Complaints Commissioner, will examine the 2003 death of a BC man who was jolted by an RCMP taser after a video of the altercation with police came to light. The Union of BC Indian Chiefs and the BC Civil Liberties Association demanded last week that the raw footage be released publicly, saying the tape they saw of Clayton Willie's death in Prince George appears heavily edited. BC Solicitor General Cash Heed said yesterday he asked Complaints Commissioner Paul Kennedy for a review. And from coverage of medicine in the news, statin effects covered up by Dr. John Briffa. An article, Briffa says, published in the Drugs and Therapeutics Bulletin, Uncommon Knowledge, Drug and Therapeutics Bulletin 2009, 47:121. Makes the point that in February 2008, the UK Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Authority stated, following a review of clinical trial data, spontaneous reports of suspected adverse drug reactions, and published literature, product information for statins is being updated to reflect a number of different side effects as class effects of all statins. 2 years later, these warnings have not made it into product information inserts. The folks at the Drug and Therapeutics Bulletin have discovered why. The proposed updates regarding side effects has been delayed throughout the European Union because one of the innovator marketing authorization holders was not in agreement with this wording. The article goes on to say, in other words, a drug company has been able to stall the inclusion of key safety warnings. In our view, this situation is unacceptable and should be rectified quickly. Even when science turns up problems, drug companies will do what they can to prevent such information seeing the light of day. Who cares that people are wandering around needlessly suffering from fatigue, muscle pain, depression, and impotence, as long as money is being made? And from the Hamilton Spectator, Jovanna Frickitich, St. Joe's MS theory sparks flood of interest. St. Joseph's Hospital will be testing a radical new theory that multiple sclerosis is a vascular disease that can be treated. The unproven theory by an Italian doctor whose wife has MS has given hope to those with the mystery neurological disease believed until now to be an autoimmune condition with few treatments. Local doctors and researchers have been swamped with thousands of calls from as far away as Alaska and California since word got out last week that Hamilton is one of the few places in Canada testing it. Dr. Mark Hack, one of the McMaster researchers involved, described it as a tidal wave. CEO Kevin Smith has given the go-ahead for research to use it for a small pilot study of the theory, which is called chronic cerebrospinal venous insufficiency. It will start in the new year and involve 20 to 30 MS patients getting MRI scans. Researchers at McMaster's Brain Body Institute at St. Joseph's will do scans that, coupled with software created by Hack, could determine whether the veins draining blood from the brain are constricted as a result of disrupted blood flow, says Italian vascular surgeon Dr. Paolo Zamboni. There's a buildup of iron that could cause many of the symptoms of MS. He performs an experimental surgery similar to angioplasty to unclog the veins and improve blood flow. He says it worked for his wife and other patients. It's essential other researchers try to reproduce Zamboni's results with larger numbers of patients to see if his theory holds. The MS Society of Canada has just put out a request for research grant proposals to study CCSVI. Hamilton plans to apply so it can expand its study beyond 20 to 30 patients. Hack has also offered to examine the scans of any MS patient who can get an MRI following the protocols he's set up. For more information, pencils ready, email info.mrimaging@gmail.com. A website is expected to be running by early this week at www.msmri.com. That's msmri.com. Okay, you're ready for the out of the cold times and places. Thursdays, Central Presbyterian Church, 165 Charlton Street West, service available through 4 p.m. Men, women, and families, soup and rolls at 4, hot meal served 5:15 to 6:30. Fridays, Wentworth Baptist Church, Cannon and Wentworth. To men, women, and families, soup and rolls at 4, hot meal 5:15 to 6:30. Saturdays, again, Service to men, women, and families, two sittings of hot meals, one served at 4:30 and second one at 5:30 at Christ Church Cathedral, 252 James Street North. There isn't a Sunday hot dinner, except if you attend the chapel at the Booth Street Salvation Army across from the library. I think the service starts at 4, and everyone who attends gets a meal ticket for Sunday dinner prepared by Flo the chef at the Sally Ann. Mondays offer a choice. The James Street Baptist Church, 96 James South at Jackson. Hot meals for men, women, and families. Soup and rolls at 4, hot meal from 5:15 to 6:30 p.m. Mondays also offer McNabb Street Presbyterian Church. Service available Monday 4 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. 116 McNabb Street South, hot meal 5:15 to 6:30. Tuesdays, you also have a choice. Again, James Street Baptist Church, 96 James South at Jackson. This is the one sponsored by Beth Jacobs Synagogue. And times are the same as Mondays. Soup and rolls at 4 p.m., hot meal 5:15 to 6:30 p.m. Tuesday hot meals are also offered at Centenary United Church, 24 Main Street West, beside the old bus mall. Soup and rolls at 4, hot meal served from 5:15 to 6:30. And Wednesday, that was yesterday, Erskine Presbyterian Church, 19 Pearl Street North. Oh, a block, what, west of Locke. Hot meals served to men, women, and families. Soup and rolls, 4 p.m., hot meal 5:15 to 6:30. And that's it for Out of the Cold from November 10th until sometime in March. And this was provided by the Community Information of Hamilton, 905-528-0104. I couldn't resist including this from Jerry Kittick in Hamilton. Globe and Mail, Friday, November 27th, 2009. This is Your Morning Smile in the Life section of the Globe. As a modern male, I stay in touch with my feelings. I keep them in a jar in my desk and visit them at least once a week. And now going out in honor of tonight's Robert Gordon show at This Ain't Hollywood, Danny Gatton. We don't have time for the whole cut, but this is most of Cruisin' Deuce. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.